everybody, the August episode of AZMcast. Jared and I have some awesome stuff ready for you this month. One of the things that we're going to start to put in is to let you know when something is actual evidence-based medicine or when this is just our crazy opinion. Sometimes it's difficult, sometimes it's not so difficult to tell which is which. So we want to make sure that you are well aware. When there is an evidence-based opinion that we are about to give, you will hear this. And that will be accompanied by a picture of the journal article that we're referencing on your podcast listening device so that you can take a screenshot of it, maybe refer to it later. When you are about to hear Jared and I start to blow smoke of our own opinion, you will hear this, which I find will usually be pretty appropriate. And lastly, when you are about to hear a fantastic new episode of AZMcast, complete with new segments like Conference Recap with Allie Min and A Critical Appraisal by Brian Drummond, as well as updates on pertussis with some of our PEDS ID experts and more on all the how-tos and ins and outs of how to be an efficient emergency doctor, you will hear this.
Yes, indeed, it's fun time.
All right, so Allie has been gracious enough to come on and do something that I think would be fun. It's just a little conference recap. You don't always make all of them. Sometimes you have a night shift, sometimes you're on vacation, and we wanted to hit some of the highlights real fast. So we were going to do highlights from the month of July. So July is great because we get started and we try to throw as much interesting stuff at you as we can, but it's still very basic and broad. So there's some finer points that you can go over and you'll pick up as you go, but we just wanted to talk about some of the things that came up that were interesting. So what did you find?
Yeah, so I think the first week we, like you said, we just try to kind of hit things broadly and things that'll be sort of high yield. I think the first day of conference, you gave a great lecture on pediatric respiratory distress with all the you're welcome, with all the videos that nobody likes to watch but are important to see, and some tips on how to recognize a sick kid and somebody that's going to need your attention sooner rather than later.
It's sick, but I actually really love giving that talk. It's very fun for me, but it's mostly just watching people squirm. Yeah. That's not cool, though.
It's better to feel uncomfortable watching those videos than actually having that patient in front of you, so I think that's a really good one. Let's see. We also had Dr. Bitterman visit and talk about EMTALA.
That was really good.
Yeah, I think there were a lot of good, important points made, and mostly that our job is, you know, first and foremost to determine whether there's an emergency and to perform a medical screening exam. And if you determine there's not an emergency, then EMTALA basically ends and your duty ends. But we talked about you really have to be an advocate for the patient and do the right thing. But legally, that sort of EMTALA is what binds you.
It doesn't protect you from being sued, but it protects you from being fined and possibly thrown in jail.
We also had a great talk about an introduction to the trauma bay, which we always do at the beginning of the year, sort of sets the tone for the new interns coming in and how to approach their first trauma patient and sort of defining roles and the hierarchy of how we do things and sort of an intro to ATLS.
I think that one of the things that's highlighted at the beginning of the year is we are one big happy family and we work as a team. If you see that breakdown start to happen, just remind people we're supposed to be working as a team, and we do best when we work as a team. So everybody's got their role to play, and we definitely want to hear feedback if things aren't going well. But if you play nice with them, hopefully they play nice with you, and we can all take care of the patient together.
And I think that was the overall point of that, the overlying theme of that hour, was that everybody wants to do what's in the best interest for the patients, and so if we all work together to that end, then it should be fine. And communication, of course, is key.
So like I said, this is last month's conference recap. Some of this stuff is a little bit fresh, maybe the wounds are still a little bit raw, but I still stand by that. We need to communicate well with them, and thank you for bringing problems to our purview so that the leadership can try to figure out what to do. So there's a two-minute summary of one day. So the next one after that, Chris Edwards, our pharmacist, and Vivian Ng had worked to put together a suggested adult antibiotogram or antibiotic reference guide as far as how we should be good stewards of our antibiotic therapy. If we just gave everybody Godzillacillin, then we wouldn't have to worry about anybody dying, but then we'd have to fight Godzilla bugs. So it was nice of them to do that. That's readily available, and if you don't have a copy, you can certainly ask any of them, and you can find it, I think, on our intranet as well. So this is learning to be a good steward of your antibiotics is important. Learning when your patient doesn't fit in that antibiotogram is also important.
Right.
So they did a good job of putting this together for us. It's a really handy tool to use.
Yeah, that was a massive effort on their part, and I think it's beneficial for all of us to sort of be have a uniform front. Then Dr. Turker came, and he's always a great teacher and gave a lecture about hand emergencies. And I think the high point for me was just a really good description of how to do a hand exam, a basic hand exam. You hit all the important motor and sensory functions and be able to communicate with your consultants in an intelligent way about what you're seeing.
We have to be able to speak so many different languages. We have to speak OB, we have to speak hand, we have to speak orthopedic surgeon, which that's not a difficult one to speak at all, actually. But we have to learn to speak these languages. And the better you can speak their language, the more they'll trust you, the faster they'll come in when you really raise the red flag. And I think that that's really important to keep in mind. You may not be able to do a hand exam like he does. I know I can't, but I can hit the gross high points. So,
absolutely.
Shrikar came in and talked about the importance of point-of-care ultrasound. And I can't tell you how many times I've just said, oh, I kind of wonder what this looks like. And something evil jumps out of the screen at me that is hiding in this patient. So if you have a question, if there's an ultrasound handy, go stick it on the place in question that you're worried about. If you don't know what you're looking at, which happened to me for years and years and years, go find somebody that does, and they'll help you out. And then you can learn from it.
Yeah. The ultrasound series that we do in conference, I think, is always a great hour. And Shrikar sort of just highlighted how pretty much anybody can do point-of-care ultrasound. It's really not difficult. It's just a matter of practicing and learning how to get the right views and know what you're seeing. And I think we all should do better with that and make an effort. And then the esteemed Dr. Leach also gave another lecture. Our core content for block for July was pediatrics. So he did his pediatric core content lecture, which is always high yield.
If you feel like there's any of the core content stuff that you're lacking, this is where the Panopto lectures are really good to look into, because you can watch them over again, you can figure out the things that you need to actually study and focus points. But man, there are certain things like eyes that I could listen to core content on eyes for months and still not really be up to snuff. So use the Panopto website, it's very helpful.
And there's also PowerPoint slides on the Google Drive. They're not up to date necessarily, but they're ones that I made from a couple years ago. And I mean, the beauty of core content is that it really doesn't change over time. So if you want some more resources, they're on the Google Drive too.
People are still dying from the same stuff, at least on the test.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And then we had the joint conference with neurology. Don't you wish there was like a special like neuro ED that you didn't have to work at? That like, oh, you have a neurologic complaint? Yeah, you should really go to the neuro
ED
down the street.
That's neurologic.
That's very strange. That's got to be super tentorial.
Yeah. So this was our first joint conference of the year, and we had the neurology department join us. And I think, you know, I think it was good on a lot of levels. We have to play nicely with all the departments, like Aaron mentioned. We have to speak to all of them, and we need their help. So it sort of helps with the collegiality a little bit to have these joint conferences. And I think, you know, the big take-home points for me were that we should really all be trying to do the NIH stroke scale for our stroke patients. You're going to use it no matter where you go. You're going to have to make the call sometimes on whether people need certain interventions and when they don't. And the NIH stroke scale is an objective measure that everybody uses. So,
and Casey Solom, who was one of our chiefs last year, and he's up in private practice in Scottsdale, he called me a little while ago and was like, man, I have to do this on my own now and decide whether or not the patient's getting TPA. This is not neurology's decision anymore. So we get a little bit sheltered in our tertiary care center, but when you go out into the world where you got to make these decisions, it's really handy to have the evidence in the back pocket to know how to do an NIH stroke scale quickly. Mm-hmm. And what Dr. Dumont was saying is, for his interventions, he doesn't care if it's a 5 or a 6 or a 6.5. He wants to know mild, moderate, severe. So if you can start with the high yield stuff like dense hemiparesis, facial droop, aphasia, level of consciousness. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that he wants to know.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're within a couple, I think that's pretty good until we learn how to do this quickly. It's like anything. Most of you that are seniors can get your H&P down to about 2 minutes now, but you didn't used to do that. So just keep adding some of these tools into your toolkit, and they will come in handy. So here with his cough is Dr. Sean Elliott. He's a professor of pediatrics. He's the residency director for the pediatrics program, and he's an infectious disease specialist.
You're here.
So we are, on top of that, he is the lead singer and guitarist for which band now?
Jammin' with Jelly.
Jammin' with Jelly. Mm-hmm. He is a notoriously rocking guitar player. So go check him out at one of the local dive bars.
Yeah, right.
He's unrecognizable.
And drink a lot when you come listen to us. Yeah, thanks, guys.
So we're entering into pertussis season. It's summertime. It's the time that URIs blossom into badness. And I wanted to just do a quick update on that. We have a pertussis outbreak at least once a year, if not every other year. Would you agree with that?
Historically, it's supposed to be every 3 years, mm-hmm. although our patterns have been more frequent than that. So just last year, we had our outbreak in Vail.
So it's usually sometime in July to October.
Correct.
That we usually see the peak seasons. And I was hoping you could just as a refresher before we get started, give us a little review of the natural course of pertussis when it shows up.
Right. So incubation period, typically 5 to 7 days, sometimes up to 10 to 14. And then the first phase will be the catarrhal phase. Very much as the name suggests, it's like a viral upper respiratory infection. So congestion, runny nose, et cetera and so forth. And not everybody experiences that. In fact, typically the younger the child, the less obvious the symptoms are until they hit the worrisome phase.
Fantastic.
Isn't that nice? Very special. So it's a great patient population to deal with. if you happen to catch the patient in that phase and happen to send testing and it's positive, then there potentially is impact for treatment at that point. You may prevent or lessen the progression through convalescence into paroxysmal phase. The big thing we all worry about, which is frequently when we see our patients, is the paroxysmal phase, otherwise known as the 100 days cough. So older patients, adults, younger children, it is truly a paroxysmal cough, strings of cough in a row, followed by the gasp of inrushing air as you try and take a breath, hence the whoop. That also, unfortunately, rarely occurs in the very young patients, where they may come in with an apparent life-threatening event, apnea, respiratory arrest. So obviously those are the scariest of the scary. So once survives all that, then one will be immune from that wild type disease for a while, but not forever.
Yeah, this is one of the ones that we, this is one of the big reasons why we make sure all those people with lax and corneal abrasions get their tetanus, not even so much for the tetanus,
right,
for the pertussis.
Yeah, when I shot myself with a nail gun, I got my Tdap right down there in the North Pod. It was great.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
We saw you in the North Pod. That was very nice of us.
Well, I called Dale, and he said I had to actually come up to see him. I'm like, oh, come on. I took the nail out. You know, seriously.
Dale shot himself with enough nail guns. So usually what we see when these patients come in, we're suspicious for that kid who has a staccato cough that turns blue or purple when they cough, and has never seen a vaccination needle. Those are the ones that are obvious that jump out at us.
Right.
Who are some of the other patients that we should have a higher suspicion for?
Right. In general, and this is a good concept for pediatric respiratory illnesses, the younger the patient, the scarier the patient. Absolutely, this is true with RSV, where the narrower the airway is, the more likely the inflammation is to occlude it. Same thing with pertussis. Although you're not really occluding the airway, but you are having basically a poisoning of respiratory epithelium, and the cilia, the ciliary motor bodies, are poisoned by the toxin from pertussis. So that means that one can actually have a closure of the upper airway, and if it is a smaller airway, it's more likely to close completely. Long way of saying, basically, infants under 1 year of age with pertussis and certainly less than 2 months of age are at much higher risk of respiratory arrest and death than would be the child who's 4 or 5 years and fully immunized.
Okay. And then we probably unknowingly see this more often than not in our adult patients that come in, they've had a cough for 3 weeks, four
right.
weeks. They feel like they've broken a rib, they've
right.
coughed up blood, they've coughed themselves into syncope. These are probably patients that are just lingering some pertussis. Is that?
Absolutely, yeah. Again, not everybody knows this in the general public, but the immunity from pertussis vaccinations, even if you get every single one of the primary series and get the boosters, that immunity wanes after 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. Hence the current push for all adults, especially in the healthcare field, to get Tdap. So like you say, it's not really just for tetanus, which is embarrassingly rare. It's really for the pertussis. So adult comes in, even one of our patients in middle school, high school, with a chronic staccato cough, which may or may not be paroxysmal, but if it's enough to break a rib or cause chest pain, you have to consider pertussis.
Now, we'll get back to kids in a little bit, but for the adults, would you recommend actually testing for this? Would you recommend just giving a Z-Pak like is so odd for us to do?
Well, you know, we will be giving a Z-Pak likely anyway, either for community pneumonia or pertussis.
Or just to get them out of the emergency department?
Well, of course. Yeah, treat them and treat them. Right, sure. Exactly. But epidemiologically, and also to make the diagnosis, it would be good to test those patients.
So this is an article that's in Pediatric Emergency Care back from 2008. It's entitled Predicting Pertussis in Infants. Hmm. And what they did is they took a selection of pertussis patients, or patients with URI-type symptoms that were tested, and they took the ones that were positive, which was only 13%.
Okay.
And they tried to figure out who was high risk among these patients. So they found that usually if they were younger, if they were between July and October, the mm-hmm. season, which mm-hmm. all so far were making sense, higher white blood cell counts and higher percentage of lymphocytes with a higher absolute lymphocytosis.
Right.
So surprisingly, the way this worked out, that's actually what I learned in medical school. That doesn't mm-hmm. happen very often anymore.
No, it doesn't. Not enough where you could hang your hat on it.
Exactly.
So you see the kid with a suspicious cough who's got 80% limps. Well, duh, that's your diagnosis. It's not mono. Unless they're all reactive, in which case you never know. But even then, it's not a thoroughly positive predictive value mm-hmm. for that finding. But it's very reasonable to consider the diagnosis.
So if you have a patient that has an absolute lymphocytosis and fits kind of the cough, cold symptoms, then you know, it's definitely something to consider, like Dr. Elliott said. But how often do you get blood on your URI patients? Probably not that
Probably
often.
Probably not so very often, yeah. Right.
So going back to say, first we're going to have a high suspicion for this. So who should we test to see, do you have pertussis? The kids that were higher risk, we just talked about, younger infants probably warrant some testing within the right season.
Right.
Patients that have an ALTI might warrant some testing if they've got mm-hmm. the symptoms. Anybody else we should consider testing?
Pretty much if you're considering the diagnosis, you need to test. So the real question is, in whom should you consider the diagnosis?
Mm-hmm.
And that's tough because, as you said, it's a nonspecific initial presentation.
Okay.
Certainly having a high index of suspicion for the younger kids, the kids with underlying respiratory issues, chronic lung disease, you would want to be thorough in your eval of an ex-preemie, for example, with a history of BPD.
Right.
So those are kids that be testing for RSV during the winter months and pertussis during really summer to fall.
Okay. What about a number of vaccines? How many DTaps should a patient get? For those of you that are non-pediatric, that's 2, 4, 6 months, a year.
A booster at 12 mm-hmm. to 15, right.
And then 4 years, four to six. So how many vaccines should we allow a patient to have before we say, you know, you've been vaccinated, you probably don't have pertussis? Or is that not a valid argument?
It's partially valid. So the protective efficacy after the very first DTaP, so 2 months of age, the first primary series, protective efficacy is anywhere from 67 to 78%. So it's not 100%. By the time you reach the third DTaP, so it's 6 months of life, now the baby is really felt to be 95 to 100% protected against active pertussis. The booster dose at 12 to 15 months brings that up to 100%, and babies usually are protected near 100% of the time up until the 4 to 5 year booster. So really the first decade of life, if baby got every single vaccine, after maybe 6 months of life, you could reliably consider them protected.
Okay.
That said, if you have the seven-year-old kid who's got classic symptomatology, you're still going to be testing,
right.
And you may be treating empirically. Also, even if one is up to date on one's immunization and has seroprotective antibody response, you can still carry the organism back home or to other non-protected individuals at home.
That's the scary part.
That's the scary. Yeah, right. Especially for those of us who have, you know, young kids at home. This actually has driven what's called the cocooning recommendation, which is for families with infants who are not yet protected, fully protected from immunization. You have to immunize everybody around them. So the middle schooler, mom, dad, maybe not the dog, but you get the picture, right? So if you can provide a pertussis-free environment at the home, then the chances of the at-risk infant from getting pertussis is much, you know, lower.
Great. Now, once we've suspected the diagnosis, we usually don't get these pertussis DFAs back within for probably about 3, 4, or 5 days.
Correct.
So who should we consider? You know, I think you just need to be treated, and we'll give you your azithromycin. And who should we say, you know, you're high risk, you need to be hospitalized, because I don't know what you're going to do when you go home.
Right. obviously, it's the clinical call every single time, but in general, infants under 1 year of age in whom you suspect pertussis are at much higher risk of losing their airway and arresting at home.
Mm-hmm.
So those would be patients you'd really want to be quite focused on admitting empirically. Kids older than that who are non-toxic, not having desaturation episodes in the ED, and who have good follow-up are probably okay to go home on azithromycin. And whom do you treat, whom do you not treat? That's a hard question to answer, right? I guess...
That's why I'm asking you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
I appreciate
you're
that, Aaron. I think if one absolutely has no other likely explanation for that presentation and pertussis is top of your list, you're going to treat.
Mm-hmm.
All the others are sort of in gray zone. And yeah, we use a lot of azithromycin, but it's a well-tolerated drug.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, especially in pertussis season, I'd be more likely to treat than not to treat.
Okay. So if we're thinking of testing, we should probably also start treatment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And it pains me to say that, because that's obviously going to precipitate overuse of antibiotic.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm thinking of, again, is our ability to capture these patients and follow up.
Mm-hmm.
And as always, that's the argument from the ED. Will they follow up? If so, you don't have to treat them empirically. They get the result, they start treatment. Remember also that by the time we capture them, the potential impact of azithromycin is low in terms of modifying disease outcome.
Mm-hmm.
We're really trying to make them non-contagious for all the other kiddies that they're exposing themselves to.
Got it. Now, once we've got a kid like the one that I had a couple weeks ago, I went into the room, said, "Hi, how are you?" Gave a kid a big hug as she left, and...
That's how you roll, is it?
That
okay?
is. I'm a good
you're,
pediatrician.
You're a good guy. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, and then we sent the kid on her merry way, and then 4 days later, you have pertussis.
Right.
So, do I need to be treated?
Right. So here again, it's the significance of the exposure. If, as you're examining the baby or a child, they cough right in your face, well, yeah, duh. All right, which happens all the time.
I've never had that not happen.
Exactly.
They always
right.
cough
it
in my face.
It always happens, right? So if you actually feel the droplets on your face, then yeah, you've been exposed. The casual interaction, so taking the history from the door, not examining the patient, kind of like the attending levels nowadays,
mm-hmm.
Probably not a major exposure. But getting close in for the actual exam, consider yourself exposed.
Okay. So this is not tuberculosis. This is not Ebola, where if you happen to walk by and make eye contact with the patient, you're probably going to get quarantined.
Yeah, if they sweat on you, then
yeah.
you're done. Yeah.
So this is one that instead we're going to, you know, if you were up close and personal, put the tongue depressor in the kid's mouth, got close enough, we
yeah.
should probably prophylax you.
Absolutely.
Now, I also have small children at home.
Mm-hmm.
I have stock in Z-Packs. No, I don't really. But so
you will.
So I did. But I just had my DTAP, or my TDAP, because I'm a big kid now.
Yes.
I just had it updated in June. And even still, even though I just had my update,
yes.
I'm still a potential carrier for this to
Correct.
Take it home to my family.
Right.
Fantastic.
Presumably, if you were a vaccine responder, you yourself won't have a risk of getting pertussis. But you could still have the organism in your nasopharynx or hypopharynx and carry that home to at-risk individuals.
Now, looking up on the CDC, looking at kind of what they recommend, their biggest concern is not only the disease in the child, but in the spread of disease. So
Right. What
they're saying on their website is that patients that are having the paroxysms that catch it, basically, that they can continue to be infectious for up to 6 weeks
Yes. After
they start.
Yes, right. And again, that's the reason to treat, certainly mm-hmm. by the time they're in paroxysmal phase. After treating with 5 days of azithromycin, then they're no longer contagious.
Okay. On day five. They are
right. Magically
cleared to go.
Better, right.
Fantastic.
Back in the evil old days when we were treating with erythromycin, mm-hmm. which was a joy to take, 14-day course of yakking every single dose,
mm-hmm.
It was still 5 days on therapy to become non-contagious.
Mm-hmm. We just had them take the rest because we hated them? Or?
Well, yeah, apparently so.
Here's your prescription
prescription.
2 weeks of diarrhea. Congratulations.
Yeah, yes, they have a thorough effect on being contagious, yes.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. One other question is, we often will have outbreaks. There'll be something on the news for pertussis. There's a pertussis outbreak in Marana, a pertussis outbreak in Vail. And we have parents that bring their kids in that are possibly the worried well, possibly
mm-hmm.
not. They were at the daycare with the same kid's nephew who had been at a birthday party, and we just want to make sure.
Right.
Are we going to run out of pertussis swabs?
No. It's really just the culture media, which you set up on slide, you know, to do the DFA and then chalk it agar.
But approaching, you know, if the media gets out there and does what it should do and make sure that people are aware of it, what do we do for people that are their kids are completely asymptomatic, but they're concerned?
Reassurance, advocating for vaccination if they haven't already,
mm-hmm.
And then just anticipatory guidance what to look for.
Okay, and that would be signs of a URI,
correct.
Runny nose,
yeah.
Cough,
yes.
And especially any of the bad things if
right.
they're younger. Okay.
Yeah.
Would you consider any kind of a significant exposure, say, our family member was diagnosed with pertussis and we just spent the weekend with them, they would need to be prophylaxed but not necessarily tested?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Because you have exposure to a known index case mm-hmm. with a significant exposure.
Okay.
So yeah, that would
Great.
Be prophylaxis.
So this is definitely a consideration. We'll see more of these. And I think to kind of summarize real quick, so you're high-risk patients are going to be your younger ones, ones that present with
right.
just ALT or apnea or seizures. I know I've taken care of at least 3 or 4 patients in the PEDS ICU that developed pulmonary hypertension from this.
Yep.
These are bad sequelae that we don't want to miss if we can fix it. If you are suspecting a patient has this, then you're going to want to swab them and put a little azithro on the other end of that so that they get their treatment. So
one-two punch.
If you're going to test, treat.
Yeah.
The ones that are at high risk that need to be hospitalized, certainly kids that are less than 1 month of age, and then depending on other social issues or fragile medical issues, maybe a little bit older.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. Every one of us needs to have our Tdap up to date because
Absolutely.
We see these kids all the time.
Yeah. Because you don't want pertussis.
No.
One of our former ped surgeons acquired pertussis and broke 3 ribs while
wow.
standing at the table, and then had post-tusk emphysis into the mask.
Wow.
She was not a happy camper.
Ugh.
No.
All right.
Yeah.
So nothing like
pertussis.
Coughing and puking on your patients
well,
when they
horrible.
Show up. So.
Especially in the open surgical field. Nice.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Sean. We'll come back when the Ebola virus hits, and we'll do some updates on that.
Serve it up.
A million ways to die.
Ah! Ah! That went south so fast! Ah!
I thought that after 5 years of residency, I would be able to learn every possible way that somebody could die. That was the thing I was most scared of as an intern, is that someone's going to try to die on me and I'm not going to know what to do. So I thought for certain, probably by my second year, yeah, I figured it all out. And every month, I would say, someone finds a new way to die that I've never thought of. So Jared, here's the case that I had. This was a 12-year-old kid that came in for syncope, and he was just kind of out playing and didn't have syncope on exertion, actually had syncope a little bit later. And I was on the floor, the pediatric floor, when this kid got admitted, and the kid had the normal syncope workup, and someone noted that his calcium on his BMP was 14. which I can count on one hand the number of times I've actually thought hard about the calcium on a BMP. Anything about a calcium of 14 that makes you worried?
I mean, everything about a calcium of 14 makes me worried. Stone heart, maybe. Yeah. Some kind of dysrhythmia, AV conduction block, being that calcium is the electrolyte that does AV conduction. Mm-hmm.
So sure enough, we got an EKG on this kid, and he had a first-degree heart block and also had a little bit of a prolonged QT. So kid got admitted, and I took over for the kid on the floor the next day, and the sign-out team said, oh, yeah, the attending overnight was called by the nurse. They didn't call us, but apparently the patient had some PVCs overnight, and they were worried about him. We said, well, how many PVCs? Well, about 12 of them, and they were all in a row. We said, that's I think that's VTAC, right? When you have a bunch of PVCs in a row, that's VTAC. The kid had to run a VTAC on the peds floor? Yeah. I guess that's what it was. Okay. Labs in the morning, calcium is now 14.8. And we start to go, holy cow, this kid is having dysrhythmias, and his calcium keeps going up and up and up. So at this point, any management stuff or anything else different you'd want to do for this kid?
First thing is you need to hydrate them up, try to dilute out that calcium. Mm-hmm. And then you need to try to get rid of the calcium with usually a loop diuretic. You can either bolus Lasix or you can drip Lasix and then replace the fluid loss as needed. And then you need to give some like pamidronate or something like that.
Okay. So we started putting the kid on maintenance and a half, and then twice maintenance, and then started some Lasix, and ended up giving this kid 2.5 times maintenance fluids with 1 milligram per kilogram of Lasix every 6 hours, a bisphosphonate, a couple other treatments, and the calcium peaked at about 15.6, and the iCal was, I think, 1.77. These are all high calcium numbers. Thankfully, the kid didn't go into VT again. But what we ended up finding on this kid was that he had a parathyroid adenoma and had something called parathyroid storm. So this is the Saturday that I find this out, and I'm running to everybody I can find. I run into Jared in the cafeteria. I run into some of the peds intensivists, and I go, have you ever managed parathyroid storm? They go, oh yeah, thyroid storm? I've managed that. No. Parathyroid storm. Everybody looked at me like I had antlers coming out of my head. So this kid had a parathyroid adenoma that was going out of control, was resorbing all of the calcium from his bone, and was literally causing dysrhythmias, which completely blew my mind. And we started calling people. We started calling some of the endocrinologists and the surgical endocrine people. And they said, oh yeah, it could be one of those men's tumors. All of a sudden, I had this horrible flashback to looking at one of the step one study books, seeing the multiple endocrine neoplasia things, and saying, yeah, I'm not going to learn this. But ultimately, I did some literature search on this and found that this actually is something that happens not uncommonly. It's more common in elderly people. They develop a parathyroid adenoma, and it goes uncontrolled. They resorb their bone, and they get hypercalcemic crises. So they get the stones, groans, moans, and psychiatric overtones. But you can actually get dysrhythmias. You can get ventricular tachycardia. So managing the calcium is an important thing. And I had never thought for a moment that someone would die of too much calcium. All those Got Milk commercials were completely wrong. They were killing people and they didn't even know it. So the important thing for managing these, this will happen a lot with tumors. This will happen with some of the other pseudo hyperparathyroidism where you've just got elevated calciums, but you need to be able to manage these. It's hydration, loop diuretics, because loops lose calcium, and the bisphosphonates usually won't kick in for a week or so. So if it's going to be something that's surgical, where you have to cut out the adenoma, that's going to be curative, and the bisphosphonates will kick in a week later when then suddenly you don't have the adenoma anymore, and now your calcium's going to tank. So we ended up taking this kid to the OR. I didn't. Someone took this kid to the OR, whacked out his adenoma, and then he spent a couple days in the ICU monitoring his calciums to make sure they didn't drop out now that this overproducing tumor was gone. The last thing we talked about is if he goes into VTAC again, do we give them a calcium channel blocker? And I found absolutely no evidence to support it, but you can bet I was going to try it.
Yeah, it's a good thought.
So hopefully that was interesting and not just my ranting about a case that scared the daylights out of me. So it's now August, so we wanted to talk a little bit about efficiency, mostly because July is kind of a transition time. We've got a lot of people in the department, and it often you don't feel the crunch because we're just saturated with residents. Now that we're starting to get back into the swing of things, I feel like the interns, the juniors, and the seniors are getting a good idea of, oh, this is what this is actually like now. So we wanted to break it down by classes to give you an idea, not even so much to set expectations, but to try to give you a little bit of help of what's to come and a little bit of what you should be focusing on. So I'm going to start with the interns. So interns, you are having to learn most of this stuff from scratch. You have a good medical knowledge base, but the actual practice of emergency medicine is something that you're going to develop with time. So the most important thing we want you to do now is learn. We want you to learn cases. We want you to learn approaches to different problems. We want you to learn what to do with different patients and to develop some medical reasoning. We also want you to learn the other parts of emergency medicine, like a little bit of how the emergency department works, how people come in, how people leave, a little bit about how people get dispoed, whether they go to surgery first or whether they need to be seen by GI. There's a lot of system stuff that you'll start to pick up. So honing in on the actual medical care is the most important thing for you right now. And then starting to pick up some of the other smaller things of how come this patient is going to go here instead of there, how come this patient needs to be seen by surgery for their choledocholithiasis prior to having GI do their ERCP. Some of these things are questions you should be asking as well. Have an idea with each patient that you have of where they're supposed to be going, why you're doing what you're doing. And if you don't know why, ask the questions now, because it doesn't seem foolish at all in August or September or October or whenever your first couple intern months are. It does seem a little bit foolish once you start asking these questions as a senior resident.
And the learning thing is not something to be overlooked. I mean, how you spend your time learning, it's important. So, you know, when we were residents, there was EM Rap, but there really weren't a lot of podcasts. Now you could spend all of your extracurricular time doing learning by podcast. And so I think you have to be a cautious consumer about what you take away from those podcasts. They're just based on volume alone. You could spend all your time listening to podcasts and be great at regurgitating people's opinions, but not really get a grasp of the underlying core content, meat of it, if you will. So I always studied by, I would do a section in Peer 8. And if it was a big section, had 40-something questions, you at the time it was Peer 7, but if there was like 40-something questions, you know that's an important question bank, so I'd go back and read the Rivers or the textbook chapter on that.
I think we're at Peer 15 now.
Are we? Old. I hear it's electronic now.
I heard that. It's on my phone.
That is crazy.
Can you believe that? It's amazing. Yeah, so Jared's right. You got to be careful what you put in, garbage out, right? So if you're listening to someone's podcast that maybe are just two idiots that happen to have a microphone, then you want to make sure you check that with other people that you're working with. I often check stuff I've learned with other people to go, hey, have you ever heard this before? And I often find that I was wrong. It's a lifelong learning thing. But you want to be focusing on your management of these patients. You want to ask your attending why we're doing this. And you'll find over time that different attendings will do things different ways. But there are a core set of critical actions that need to be performed on any patient that almost all of your attendings will agree on, that there are critical actions that need to happen for a patient that comes in with chest pain. The other thing that as interns you should really focus on is sick versus not sick. If you have any questions of sick or not sick in your mind, that's when you need to get your attending. And it's better to get your attending more times than not and then start to hone in on who's sick and who's not, than to say, I'm pretty sure I got this on my own. The last time I thought that was my first shift of my intern year when I pushed epi on a 2-year-old with asthma. without my attending in the room. Let's just say that I learned to get my attending after that one. Kid did fine, but did not need epi. Charts will also come with time. It's really important to get your charts done and to develop good habits as an intern so that as you go on and you see more patients, you streamline yourself. But with the amount of patients that you'll be seeing, just make sure you keep up on your charts so it's not one more hassle that impedes your learning. But believe it or not, charts are actually a part of learning, which Jared's going to talk about with the juniors.
Yeah, so the juniors, the biggest thing is now your expected volume has exploded. You've built this towards the end of your year. You've figured out your workflow. Everything's going to go great. But now the nurses are going to call your phone instead of your senior's phone for you to come see the trauma patient or the sick patient coming into whatever room, whatever. And so you're going to spend a lot more of your time waiting for that sick patient to come in or taking care of those sick patients that now the red X's are going to start piling up on the board. So the hard part about junior year is figuring out how to multitask to see all those patients and not wind up with 30 charts at the end of each shift that need to be then completed. The other thing about junior year is now you've seen a fair number of patients so far in your residency. You're starting to know some things. You're starting to get really good at what your workflow is. And you've seen enough patients to know that most of them don't have anything. And so you start to get anchored into this. These patients aren't sick. Nobody's ever sick. And you start to blow stuff off. You start to say, I don't really know why their SAT is lingering around 90%, but I don't have an explanation for it. It must be nothing. I'm going to blow it off. Some of those patients truly are sick. And the other thing is that you start to see patients just as whatever their chief complaint is on the board, weak and dizzy, chest pain, abdominal pain, and you start to anchor into that diagnosis and you don't consider alternative diagnoses because most patients are just chest pain rule out, abdominal pain rule out, so on and so forth. So the hard part about junior year is fighting through that. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's you start to see more patients than you ever thought possible. I know some of the juniors are saying, I saw X amount of patients, I didn't think that you could see that many patients, and yet you're doing it. You should feel your junior year just a little bit of uncomfortableness.
Dangerous.
Yeah, you should feel, well, not dangerous. Like, you should feel like, you know, maybe you're pushing yourself, you're a bit uncomfortable, but if you're feeling dangerous, you probably do need to back off a little bit.
Well, that's a matter of perspective. If your attending thinks you're dangerous,
that's
then you
true.
Should back up.
I don't like you because you're dangerous.
That's right. Nice, man. I am dangerous.
So I think that it can definitely be a lot of burnout. All you feel that you're doing all day is charts. Every patient looks like another chart to you. And you're like, I could see another patient, but it's just another chart to do. And besides, they all have chest pain. We admit them all. Nothing happens to any of them. And like Jared said, you can easily have that point of view, and it's very common during your junior year. So we want to try to help you avoid that by saying, keep looking. The more chest pains you pick up, the eventually you're going to get that patient that has Wolff Parkinson White with aberrancy and has SVT. You're going to pick up that patient that's got an aortic dissection. You're going to pick up that patient that has got a massive PE just because you keep dutifully going through and seeing them all. Keeping your horizons open as well, because hopefully by this point you've learned sick versus not sick. So when you walk into the room and go, oh, this is a sick chest pain. Oh, I approach this a little bit differently.
Your junior year is also the time where you got to, whatever you do to keep yourself sane, if it's riding bikes or climbing rocks or something or art or whatever it is, making music, do that. Because every junior hits this rut around January where you start to think, my God, I still have half my residency left and you're tired and you're burnt and you've done all your hard off-service rotations in the ICUs and whatnot. So you got to do whatever you have to do to keep yourself sane.
Mm-hmm. So for your charts, try to learn a little bit more efficiency. I was not the most efficient resident, but I learned after time, if I do a little bit more during my shift, that's a little bit less I have to do after my shift. So just push yourself, even on the charting, when you get to the end of your shift and you're exhausted, just do it anyway. And then you get to sleep in the next day, come back for more.
6 days in a row.
If you're lucky. That's an easy week. 6 days in a row. No, we, Jared and I actually said, both of us were like, we don't really remember how to be interns, but junior year and senior year kind of burned into your brain because it's a lot of work, but this is really where you learn how to do it well. So seniors, you've gotten through that. You know it's true. You know that you can actually get through your junior year. But you now have a different perspective of where you're looking for real jobs, you're starting to get your CVs together, you're looking for that light at the end of the tunnel. And then we give you medical students. And most of you probably cannot remember what you were like as a fourth-year medical student. It's probably been a long time to remember, man, it's I haven't thought about that. I guess there was a point where I didn't know how to do this. First thing you should do is pat yourself on the back because congratulations, you did learn how to do it. Second thing you should do is try to put yourself in the shoes of these medical students. You want, at that time, you wanted a little bit of autonomy. But now you know that if you give someone too much autonomy as a medical student, people can sometimes get hurt. It's a very fine line, and you want to be able to gauge your medical students and know who's sick and who's not. Where do you need to be? Where are you most useful? And how are you going to help teach these medical students to do something, to learn something that's going to further their career? Because eventually they're going to be in your shoes as well.
Yeah, I have a couple things to add about senior year. The first is that senior year is where you determine who you're going to be the rest of your career. And I really think there's no right answer. If you asked all of us, we would all tell you something, a little variation from the mean, which is that, well, you have to take care of everybody. But if you asked me, I would say that my philosophy is that you should prioritize the sickest patients first. Others might say that you need to prioritize the lobby first or seeing the majority of patients first. You stabilize the sick ones and get them upstairs where they need to be, and it's the upstairs problem. My philosophy is a little bit different. So there's really no right answer, but you have to figure out who you are in your senior year. The second thing is that interns want to be told everything to do. Just tell me what to do because I'm scared and they don't have the knowledge base quite yet. Juniors just want to be left alone. I know what I'm doing. I've seen some patients. Just leave me alone and let me do it my way. But when you're a senior, that's the time. You know some things. You've seen some things. You've done some things. Now it's time to start picking the brain of your attending and say, why do you particularly like to do things this way? Why do you particularly like to do the same thing differently? And I think senior year is where you can really start to fine-tune how you're going to practice medicine based on the nuances of the different faculty that you identify with.
Yeah, I think you can determine, am I going to be somebody that is risk-tolerant, risk-averse? Am I going to be somebody that needs to sit down and spend 15 minutes with my patient, going over return precautions, making sure that we've discussed everything? Or am I somebody that's just, you know, I've done the best I can, this is what I need to do, and now I need to go see the next patient to help everybody? Different people have different things that help them sleep at night. I know for me, I spend a lot of time talking with patients afterwards, and it makes for an exhausting night to be talking all night. But that's what really helps me, and that's the kind of doctor that I have, that's what makes me comfortable in my practice. Whereas other people are able to go in, immediately strike up a rapport, get in, get out, and get on to the next patient. I think learning to run an ED from that perspective is very useful. Figuring out eventually when I am in charge of an ED, whether I'm single coverage, whether I'm dual coverage, you're usually not going to have much more than that. How am I going to run the ED? How am I going to keep things going? How do I communicate with my charge nurse? How do I know what the status of the lobby is? Some of these things are things that as a senior you can start to pick up. You will still have the medical students with you, that your role at that point is still as an educator, but you can start to pick up these other things as well. That tends to happen, I think, a little more towards the end of your senior year as the realization hits, oh, wow, this is actually going to be on me.
Yeah, and you all ask a lot of thoughtful questions of how am I going to handle this if I'm in a single coverage ED in private practice, so on and so forth. And the reality is that a lot of us don't really know because we've never practiced in that environment. So one thing that we're going to try to do this year is we're going to try to get some people on the horn, some of our friends that work out in those areas, get them on the show and try to help them answer some of these questions for you.
One last thing I wanted to say about the medical students is these medical students are very eager to be here. They very much genuinely want feedback, and I think that you should try to give it to them when you can, even though it's exhausting at the end of your shift. To try to give some feedback, but try to think of something that they can work on. Also, your teaching that you're going to give them doesn't have to be on a whiteboard with an outline. It can be little pointed learning points that have to do with what they're interested in. This is especially true near the end of the year when they start to say, I'm going into rad onc,
I'm going into orthopedic surgery, I'm going into pediatrics, and I'm just doing my ED month. When these medical students come through, it's a lot easier to start your shift and say, what are you interested in? What are you going into? What did you match in? And when that happens and they tell you what they are interested in, then that's what you teach them, because we interact with absolutely everybody in the emergency department. And I can tell you, most of us have an opinion on any of the other specialties too, because we send patients to them, we get patients from them, and I think you can have a big impact on them by showing them that the ED is not just a place where you send patients because it's 4:30 on a Friday. Some of these things are things that we can teach our medical students that are valuable.
Yeah, and don't forget, a lot of the nurses are in nurse practitioner school, and they're interested in a lot of this stuff too, so take the time to talk to them when they have questions.
So all in all, this is a learning curve. Jared and I were talking about, didn't we just do this last year? And I said, I'm pretty sure we should do this every year, unless you guys tell me not to. We should do this every year, because as an intern, you're not really listening to the senior portion. As a junior, you're not really listening to this intern portion anymore. So depending on which way you're going, you may need to hear this again. So if you'd like a refresher, we'll do this every year. If you don't, you go, we just did this last year, you're wasting my time, give me more Million Ways to Die, then we'll do that instead.
Yeah, keep in mind, every year that passes, our snow got a little bit deeper and the uphill both ways got a little bit steeper.
Are you referring to your hair or no? Your hair looks great, by the way.
It's just glorious
right
now.
It's beautiful. It's a thing of beauty.
So now I have the pleasure of introducing Brian Drummond, who is going to be our first ever peer reviewer. When Jared and I talked about our biggest problems with podcasts in general, we said it could easily just be two idiots with a microphone telling their opinion. So we decided to bring in a third tiebreaker to discuss our podcast, bring out what they thought were the highlights, and critique some of the stuff. I think it's very important. I think it's something you should be doing on your own whenever you're listening to any podcast or any lecturer, which is a self-critique, a self-analysis of, is this something I want to actually put in my mind? So Brian's going to listen to it. He's going to take all of our hard work that we've put hours and hours into, and he's going to tear it to tiny bits. So Brian, please be gentle.
Hi, this is Brian Drummond for the Arizona EM Podcast. I have been graciously asked to do a little review and some critiques, and you know, Jared and Aaron are some pretty smart guys, but let's see if I can just add some summary points and maybe give you a clinical perspective. First is pertussis. Obviously a good talk. Pertussis is on the rise nationwide, and we're trying to make sure it doesn't spread in an endemic fashion. So I think there's two goals with pertussis you have to think about. One, you want to not let babies die. That is bad. And the babies are the ones that get pertussis and die. The second part is adults are the carriers and teenagers. So you want to vaccinate the adults and teenagers. So prevent the babies from dying and vaccinate your adults and teenagers. So the better your herd immunity is, the less likely you're going to have babies dying. Now, the problem with pertussis is it presents like an upper respiratory infection. So me in the ED, I can't always see every URI and test for pertussis, especially in babies. Kids less than one will have colds. No, they don't have pertussis. Yes, they will survive. No, they will not die. So what do I do? Well, for me, I'm going to test the kids most likely in that second catarrhal phase, the chronic cough, the kid that doesn't look good, has low SATs, is coughing to the point where they're turning blue. Maybe they have a whoop, maybe they don't, but they're just not looking right. So those are the ones that I think you need to test. Now, if they look good and the kid's happy, I'm not always testing in the URI phase. So I think you want to go after the ones that you think have a chronic cough and likely signs of pertussis. Now, in terms of treatment, you can't treat every upper respiratory tract infection for pertussis, and you can't get a result back, so you can't empirically start all these kids on azithromycin. So, again, use your risk factors. If they look like they could possibly have pertussis, you're probably going to be more catching and clearing them and their family members from having the disease and spreading it than you're really going to be treating that newborn. So the goals For adults and teens, you're trying to vaccinate them to help prevent the babies from dying and make sure you're looking for those sick little kids that could have pertussis and taking care of them. And those are the ones you want to treat, their family members, as well as consider admission. Next topic, hypercalcemia. Quick little patient. I think your big takeaways with hypercalcemia are, if you think hypercalcemia or see it, think cancer. Hypercalcemia equals cancer. You can also think hyperparathyroid hormone, but hyperparathyroid hormone-like substances mean cancer. So think about hypercalcemia, think cancer. The other pearl I would add, if the QTC is longer than the PR, think hypercalcemia. And the treatment, IV fluids and Lasix. Last part Jared and Aaron were hitting on was education. So I think a lot of you residents out there go through a process, which is great. We've all been through it. And so here's my take on education. Interns. I think all interns should have some textbook that they use as a reference point. And that reference point for textbooks is really creating a framework or structure of knowledge. You don't know what you don't know. So this is the time where you learn some basic information about disease process, diagnosis plans, treatment plans. Now that framework you may remodel throughout your career. You may add on or subtract from podcasts and clinical experience and journal articles, but you need to have a basic framework to build on before you can start deconstructing things. So get that framework your intern year. The other aspect in your intern year I think you really need to focus on is finding an area where you think you can improve your efficiency. So you're seeing patients, maybe you're not asking the right questions all the time, maybe you're having trouble charting in the room, maybe the nurses are calling you all the time. Try to find areas in which you can improve your efficiency. This will help you your next 2 years. You don't have to make those changes necessarily your first year, but you're really just trying to identify them. So interns, the third thing would be if you pick up a patient, make sure you complete that patient's eval until you have nothing else to do on them. The charting's done, the labs are ordered, everything's ready to go. Now go pick up another patient. Don't putz around, try to pick up three patients and they're all incomplete. I think that's when you get into trouble and you'll slow down your flow and you'll find yourself in all kinds of problems. Next are the juniors. So juniors, the big thing that you need to think about and know is at some point in your junior year, you are going to be the cock of the rock. You're going to think you know everything. You think your attendings are fools. You think everyone else is an idiot. That's okay. That's a normal progression of learning. But know you're going to fall off that rock as soon as you get cocky. So what do you really need to focus on that year? You need to make sure you're maximizing your efficiency. This is where you picked up things your first year, your intern year. You know what you need to work on. This year, you're making sure you get efficient. For seniors, what you're going to notice is that cockiness is gone. You are now seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, which is exciting, but you are also scared. You're about to poop your pants because you have to make decisions with no one else's help. And that's tough. Everyone goes through it, and we all have to go cut our teeth somewhere. So know that that's going to happen, but this is your opportunity to take lots of cases and learn. So use your senior year for that. You also, seniors, need to understand that you're going to have to look at the whole ED process, from the waiting room to triage, to patient movement, to consultants, to your charge nurse, your other nurses, your garbage taker-outers, as well as the people cleaning the room. The whole process you have to understand and take in. That's going to help ensure that you deliver good patient care and keep your emergency room functioning. And in part of this, I think you need to have internal timers or clocks in your head. You need to know if I order a CT scan of the abdomen without contrast, it's going to take approximately 30 to 40 minutes before that's in the computer. You also need to know my labs are taking 90 minutes to return, so I need to start to look for my labs around the 80-minute mark. You start to get these times in your head because if you don't, you'll be like, did I forget about that patient? I don't know. But if you have these timers going off, you'll start to look for things and be ahead of it. You'll be the first one to see that CT scan come up. You'll be the first one to get those lab tests. And the patients aren't sitting there. They're much happier. They have an answer, and they can go on their merry way, either upstairs or out the building. Thank you, Jared and Aaron, for inviting me to do a little contribution here. I appreciate it. Hopefully I gave you some quick clinical pearls, as well as hitting on some reinforcement of the good things that they cover in this talk. All right. Talk to you guys next month. Bye.
Come on. Give me your best shot. I'll give you a free one. Let me have it.
Okay, so maybe not the most hard-hitting of reviews, but man, do we appreciate that. That was a nice synopsis of what we tried to get across. We appreciate it, Brian. And if you notice, Brian had a little bit different opinion. I didn't edit anything Brian had to say because he was our reviewer. I took out a couple ums and ahs, but that's about it. So we're going to do this every month, and as we have more and more evidence, more and more papers that we discuss, more and more controversial topics, we want to encourage our reviewers to be more critical and to give their opinion and to give their own evidence in order to review and critically appraise the stuff that we're saying. So Brian, thank you so much. We hope you enjoyed this month's episode of AZMcast. As always, if you have a suggestion for what you'd like to see us do, things you'd like us to stop doing, or if you have a suggestion for a segment you actually want to be on the podcast, we greatly welcome any input that any of you have. We want to make this for you guys, and we will see you in September.